Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. Jim Douglas in today for Rick on Vermont Viewpoint. Welcome. We've got a jam-packed show for you. We're going to start in just a minute with Tracy Dolan, the newly minted director of our state refugee office. She's been on the job a week, so she knows all about it, and will tell us about Vermont's role in resettling Afghan refugees, and perhaps we can talk about resettlement more generally, too. At 9:30, Anson Tebbets is going to be with us. He's the Secretary of Agriculture, of course, and there's a big story about organic dairies losing their market in the news this past week, so we'll talk about that and other developments in the field, so to speak. At 10 o'clock, we're going to have Amity Schles on. She's the chairman and CEO of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. We're coming up within 2 years of the centennial of the president's inauguration, which happened in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, in the wee hours of the morning, and we'll talk with Amity about plans for the centennial and other activities. And at 10:30, Matt Dickinson will be with us. He's the professor of political science at Middlebury College, who is a pundit extraordinaire, and we'll talk about the president's sagging poll numbers, what it means for the midterms, what it means for his congressional agenda, and whatever else comes to our minds at the time. So, great show today. Glad you're with us, and we want to dive right into our conversation with Tracy Dolan, who's the director of our state refugee office. Tracy, welcome to WDEV.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Now, this is a new gig, as I mentioned. You've been our deputy health commissioner for a decade. You've been key in leading Vermont's best-in-the-nation response to the pandemic and making sure we're all as healthy as possible. And now you've got a new responsibility. And I didn't realize until you were appointed that it's really quite consistent with your experience. Tell us what you've done over the past 25 or so years.
Sure. So we'll walk down memory lane, will we? Okay. I actually got my start in public health in northern British Columbia. I was working with First Nations populations there in the area of HIV. And from that, I moved into international public health. So I worked internationally in public health for a little more than a decade, all over the world with a focus in sub-Saharan Africa and also India, Central America. But toward the end of that period, I also got involved in child protection in post-conflict environments. So the war in northern Uganda, some other conflicts, but also notably Afghanistan. So I was in Afghanistan in 2002 after the Taliban fell. And so, of course, this connection right now is both professional and deeply personal to me as well.
Well, we couldn't have a better person leading our state refugee office, so thanks for signing on to this new responsibility. Tell us what the role of the state office is. I know the feds have a program for resettlement, but how will you interact with them? What will your responsibilities be?
Great. Well, I'm just learning this, so let's try out my elevator speech right now. I am the director of the state office. In Vermont, we have somewhat of a hybrid model, and so different states run it differently. But in Vermont, we have a settlement agency. Our one approved settlement agency right now is USCRI, and they are responsible ultimately for resettling, housing, connecting people to services. The State Refugee Office liaises with the State Department's Office of Refugee Resettlement, and we are provided funding that we then grant out to grantees like the USCRI. We coordinate and make sure everyone is on the same page. We're looking to see what the gaps are, and we're looking to see what Vermont needs. Part of my job is to ensure that we're aligning with what the governor is looking for. And in this case, that's a great thing because we've got a governor who's very committed to expanding our refugee program. In part, it helps us to have a workforce and, of course, very importantly, helping families fleeing from danger. So really coordinating that, making sure we're matching up, talking to a lot of people, making sure we're coordinated, people are getting the resources they need, and then matching up with state resources where necessary. So if we have a state initiative that's moving forward, how do I connect that over to the refugee program? How are we ensuring that all Vermonters, including new Vermonters who might be refugees, are accessing the services they need?
Well, we certainly need people here, don't we, to fill our workforce, and we see student populations declining. We could use more working families with kids, and we look forward to that. Vermont's always been a receptive place for refugees. I'm old enough to remember the Southeast Asian wave in the 70s. We've had folks from the Balkans who've come more recently, some from Africa. So I hope this will be another successful chapter in that long history. What are you hearing now from communities around the state? Where are refugees likely to be settled?
Well, we're hearing from communities all over Vermont just opening their arms and saying, we'd really like to welcome people here. So that's the great baseline place that we're in. People saying, I'd like to host a family. Can I figure out housing for them? Can we, businesses saying, I'd look forward to hiring people. So a lot of interest all over the state. The interesting thing about this is that when we house and settle a new community, you want the community to be big enough that they'll stay so that they have glue and connections to each other. So not just connections to our Vermonters in the community, but also to others who are coming from the same situation they are. So that's the balance we make here. As much as we'd like to get this community of new refugees everywhere in Vermont, we also need to be strategic and do it in a way that they will stay. And so we're likely looking at probably a limited number of places and then ideally more families, probably starting in Chittenden. We do know that families that end up in Chittenden are more likely to stay in part because their services. But we also know that we have other centers in Vermont, like Rutland, like Central Vermont, Montpelier, and some other areas where there are services, there's good infrastructure. The key is to get a big enough number, a critical mass in a community so that we can ensure that it makes sense for them to stay.
That does sound logical. Obviously, you want some kind of critical mass so they have a community with which they can associate. We had a little hiccup with the Syrians a couple of years ago in Rutland, but I think it wasn't receptivity so much as transparency. So you'll be, I'm sure, very transparent, getting as much information out as possible.
Yeah, that is the key. I think that's a lesson we learned from public health that I can carry into this job, too. People are concerned if they think you have more information than they do and you're not telling them. Now, often, I like to say you sometimes credit all of us with a lot more strategy than we have. When you don't hear something, sometimes there's not much more to say. But if we do have information, absolutely letting people know, and letting people know when we don't know the answers. So yesterday, USCRI was in Rutland. Speaking to the board of aldermen there, just opening it up, asking questions, or being asked questions, so answering questions, and just sharing what we know. And so we'll do that throughout. And that's another role for my job as the director of the refugee office, to just let folks know what's going on and keep that communication flow going.
I think that's a key strategy. I remember years ago when we were looking to locate the facility in Bradford for Vermonters, women and adolescents at that point who were having issues with substances. And it was so important for your predecessor at the time and others to be engaged with the community on a regular basis. Is there a website or how could folks get in touch with you if they are interested in providing some service or welcoming refugees?
The best way for them to help out is to reach out to USCRI. So if they go to the website for USCRI, they can find the Vermont page, and there is an email there that you can send your offer of help to, and they have a volunteer coordinator, and they're taking names, they're taking that information now, so that when we have Afghan refugees arriving or any refugees arriving, they have a group of people to go to.
So uscri.gov probably .something.
Right? I don't have it right.
Oh,
that's
all right. Well, Google's can find anything for us these days. So uscri, go to that website and get information on how you can help. We're chatting with Tracy Dolan, who's the director of the State Refugee Office, about welcoming Afghan refugees. Do we have other refugees still coming to Vermont from other parts of the world?
We do. We have a very small number. So from about 2008 to 2016, we had a pretty healthy number of refugees coming in, above 300 a year. 2017, that dropped off pretty dramatically. And then after that, we were down to, 50, 60, I think this year 30. So a big drop. But we have had refugees coming in in the last few years, primarily from the Congo, Somalia, and Bhutan. And so as part of this, of course, in addition to the Afghan refugees, other refugees coming in, of course, are still welcome, and we will be receiving those.
Well, that's great. As I mentioned earlier, I think Vermont's been very receptive to refugees throughout our history, and we'll continue to provide that opportunity for our new neighbors from Afghanistan in the very near future. I want to ask you about one report that I saw on CBS last night. The Secretary of Homeland Security was on being interviewed, and the question was vetting, and I'm sure a lot of Vermonters are wondering about that. I'd be interested in your understanding of what happens there in terms of health vetting and security vetting, because the report suggested that there are 10 Afghans who've already come to the United States who are on a terrorist list, and the secretary assured the reporter that they'll be dealt with. But give us some level of comfort so that folks who'll be in our communities will be healthy and safe.
Absolutely. There are two levels of security vetting that occur. Some of it occurred before people even left Afghanistan. Some of them had already received special immigrant visas or were in the process. And so that vetting was already underway through the State Department using a variety of their security background check methodologies. Others that I'm sure Vermonters have heard about did not have a chance to go through a lot of process because things happen very quickly. And those are the Afghans coming over on humanitarian parole status. It doesn't mean parole in the way that we think of parole, but it's a humanitarian status, and it's meant for this type of emergency situation. And they will be vetted at places outside of the United States, so the vetting occurs primarily outside of the United States. And if there is an issue and they arrive into the United States, there's another level of vetting that happens there. And if something is caught, they are then processed differently. They would obviously not go into the refugee program until they were cleared. The health vetting, so there is a medical screening that occurs when they arrive here into the United States, things like COVID vaccination, TB tests, other vaccines. And so they are checked for infectious diseases. They are vaccinated. And then any follow-up health occurs when they arrive in state. So if they were to arrive in Vermont, we would continue with any follow-up health services here.
Well, that's comforting, I'm sure, to Vermonters to know that we'll have folks who are in good shape from a health and security standpoint. We want to make sure that Vermonters know how they can help, and I suppose that you're getting inquiries of different kinds, some who might be able to offer housing, some might be able to offer jobs, some might be able to offer other types of support. So tell us what you need and how people can reach out.
Sure. Right now, USCRI, as I mentioned, is our agency, our resettlement agency. They have a email address, so if people want to volunteer or offer their services, you can email them at vrrp@uscrivt.org. So one more time, that is vrrp@uscrivt.org. And the kinds of things people are offering and that are needed, for example, host families. It's likely when first the families arrive, we will likely place them with host families, again, ideally in close proximity in a particular community until such point as they're able to get their own housing. The unique piece of this program is that they're also arriving immediately with employment authorization, and so they will be able to look for work immediately. And just thinking here about the kinds of folks coming over, a lot of these people are highly qualified, highly educated. Many of them probably speak more languages than you or I, although, Governor Douglas, I'm not sure how many languages you speak.
Немножко.
Okay. All right. And so, you know, just putting yourself in the shoes, imagine you are, an Afghan woman living in Kabul or somewhere, and you are an English teacher at an American-run school, and your husband is a translator who's been helping the military, and you have a few kids, and suddenly you are on the run because you may be on a Taliban hit list. Imagine the uprooting, leaving everything you know, quickly having to get on a plane and arrive in the U.S., and you're scared. You're worried for your other relatives at home because it's likely that you have extended family that are still at home. And so, again, these folks have so much to offer us. They have given us so much. I can tell you from my experience even 20 years ago, the things that your interpreters do for you, you're pulled over by a militia in some remote area and your interpreter speaks very quickly and suddenly the militia drives away, and you know that they probably told them some tall tale, and they're saving your life, you know. Even the drivers, the driver will be driving along and suddenly sweating and backing up, and you realize you're on a road that hasn't been cleared for landmines, and your driver has just put themselves at risk, you know. So these are people who have put their lives on the line, who are often highly qualified, and who are really running for their lives. So what an opportunity for us to be able to open our arms and welcome people who helped our troops, but also an opportunity for us to then get the services and all the skills that they come with and to add to our workforce.
Well, you're certainly right. There's a lot of talent there. I remember when the Balkan wave or wavelet of refugees came to Vermont some years ago. I was serving as state treasurer, and a new refugee was serving as the janitor in the building, and I'd see her come in and empty the wastebasket every late afternoon, and after a little while, she'd start to say hi and how are you, and I learned that she had been an accountant in her native country, and I thought, well, that's what we do here in the treasurer's office, so I hired her. And her English skills took a little while to develop, but from a talent standpoint, from doing the work in the accounting division, she was just fine. And in fact, she was so good that the darn tax department stole her from her, and she went over there after a while. So this, to your point, Tracy, that just because there may be a language barrier, or there may not be, there are a lot of skilled workers who are going to be joining our workforce, and we need to take advantage of them. As everybody knows, we need them in Vermont for our economic future. Tracy Dolan's our guest. She's the director of the State Refugee Office. And you mentioned earlier that there was some discussion with the Rutland aldermen about possibilities there. Are you looking for organizations to step forward? I remember in the 70s, the church to which my wife and I belong was active in resettling some Southeast Asian refugees, for example.
Well, we certainly have some churches that are coming forward. We have groups of volunteers who have been working in the past and who may have been disbanded over the last 4 years because we haven't had a lot of activity. They're picking up again. Really, families, organizations, churches, businesses, and mayor's offices, and you know, development corporations from you know, soup to nuts. We have all kinds of people stepping forward. I think, you know, housing obviously is one of our challenges. We recognize that, especially in Chittenden County, but in other parts of Vermont too. So that will be a place for us to be thoughtful. What are the creative ways that we can help? The governor's office is moving forward, the state, with a $250 million housing initiative for affordable housing. Hopefully that is one initiative that might be made available to obviously a lot of Vermonters, but maybe some of our newer Vermonters too coming from this situation. So we recognize there are going to be some challenges, and we're really hoping people can put their heads together and help out and figure this out. Educational services, you know, obviously employment. Now, that's not going to be as big a challenge. You know, we do have a lot of employment, ideally employment that, includes a livable wage, obviously, for families. But we do have a significant vacancy rate, so that's an opportunity.
Yeah, housing, you mentioned, really is a problem for a lot of folks here, as you rightly point out, and we'll see how that goes. We don't have affordable housing. I used to suggest it's an oxymoron because a lot of working families are having trouble finding it, and now we're going to bring in some more folks. But as you say, there are some creative ideas on the horizon. Let's hope that there's greater receptivity to moving forward there. You mentioned educational programs. Some of these folks will need English language training, right? So are there specific plans to integrate them into our educational system?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways we do that. One way is that the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the federal program, does provide funding that we then in turn grant out to organizations to provide English language learning for families and for adults, but also, of course, the kids going into school. And so that is an adjustment there. Some schools are ready for that and already have programs. Other schools, depending on the area, you know, that might be something they need to build upon, and that may rely on both bringing in teachers, or it may rely on ELL, on volunteers. But in some cases, the kids may already come with language skills. You know, that's the thing that we don't know about yet. So that's sort of that's the spontaneity of this work in some ways, you know, seeing who arrives, what their skills are, what their needs are, and then quickly wrapping those services around.
Maybe the older folks who need more language training than the kids. I remember once visiting an office in Central Asia in Russia and talking with a guy through an interpreter, but his 5 or 6 or 7 year old kid was playing English video games and having a wonderful time. So we'll see, but it's good to have those plans. And from a religious standpoint, these are mostly Muslims, I presume. And a lot of them from the Balkans were, and so we have an active community in Chittenden County, so I assume they'll be involved too.
Yeah, I would think so. You know, I don't know as much about that right now, but I would think certainly they would connect there. And that's part of the need when we go outside of Chittenden County as well, to be trying to house and settle more families together, in part so they can have that connection as well.
Well, Tracy, we're almost out of time, but I want to make sure our listeners have another chance to know how to get in touch and give us the acronym or the abbreviation once again.
Sure. Again, if you are looking to offer your services, it is VRRP@USCRIVT.org. And I'll just note that USCRI is our resettlement agency. However, there is another agency that's looking to open up a chapter in Brattleboro, and that is ECDC. And so that's the Ethiopian Community Development Council. They're not just for Ethiopian refugees. They're for anyone. And so they're also hoping to open up a chapter and accept families as well.
So USCRI, Google that if you can't remember all the rest of the letters. Well, Tracy Dolan, Director of the Vermont State Refugee Office, thank you so much for your time here. Best of luck in your new responsibilities. And we'll look forward to welcoming a lot of Afghan refugees to Vermont.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Jim Douglas in today. What a great conversation we had with Tracy Dolan, the new director of the Vermont State Refugee Office. A lot of opportunities to invite Afghan refugees to come and settle here, to be a part of our communities, to be a part of our workforce. And once again, USCRI is the basic website that you should Google and then find the VRRP Vermont connection to it and offer whatever assistance you would suggest. And she's going to be reaching out to communities and organizations to try to make this process go well. And I'm sure it's going to because we certainly need to build up our working age population in Vermont. So hope you can help. Well, we're honored to be joined in this half hour by Anson Tebbets, a familiar voice here at Radio Vermont, an emeritus reporter and news personality here, now our Secretary of Agriculture. Anson, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, good morning, and I'm just glad you've returned to your roots as well. I think, didn't you begin your career at radio station Middlebury, if I remember?
Well, that was before many of our listeners were born, but yes, once upon a time.
You were a DJ, right? Were you a DJ?
Yeah, WRMC, the Middlebury College Station, started a modest 15-watt FM on campus there, and Brian Collimore, who's now the senior senator from Rutland County, was a classmate, is a classmate, and a colleague on the radio station. Then I worked at WFAD and the commercial CBS affiliate in Middlebury for a while. Yeah, the golden era. And speaking of that, yeah. Anson, well, tell us about your memories of WDEV. This is the 90th anniversary, and there was a big celebration this summer. What was it like when you were here?
Well, it was wonderful. It was my first, paying job off the farm. I'm coming to you from Cabot right now, but it was my first paying job. And I began as they called them stringers. You may remember Brian Joyce, who was the former news director at WDEV and went on to Channel 3. Brian would he hired me to cover city council meetings, breaking news in central Vermont. So I'd take my little tape recorder with me and go to these meetings and then file a report. I used to actually file them from the barn. We had a great phone in the barn, a classic old black phone that was on the wall. And I used to file them from there. And then went off to school in, near Fenway Park, Emerson College. And when I came back, I was blessed enough to be hired by WDEV. I started as a copywriter. I was writing commercials. And then full-time went into news and was blessed to be a reporter and news director. And then from there, I went over to WCEX and took my storytelling skills onto television. So, but it's been a part of my life, still part of my life, still doing the Bird Show on weekends with Chip, and before that with Brian Pfeiffer. And all began by listening to Red Sox baseball and news and sports in the barn milking cows.
Well, you've had a great career, and we're honored that you've spent part of it in state government, first as Deputy Secretary and now as Secretary of Agriculture. And speaking of government, I don't want the show to pass without noting that today is the 80th birthday of our junior United States Senator. Yes, that means the senior senator is even older. So happy birthday, Bernie, a frequent listener and guest here at WDEV, and he's certainly not slowing down, is he?
Absolutely. Well, happy birthday to Senator Sanders. And I see he was out and about over the Labor Day weekend in Vermont talking to Vermonters, and he's got an incredible role on the national stage now as we're developing policy.
Well, yes, and speaking of policy, let's talk about agricultural policy. We it seems, often have the same conversation about the declining number of dairy farms in Vermont and declining number of milkers, of cows, and even more recently, a slight decline in the amount of production. For a while, even though the herd sizes were growing on individual farms, the total number of cows going down, the total milk production was pretty stable because of better feed mixes and animal health practices, but that's starting to drop now. And then we had the announcement this past week that Horizon, a company that was a milk producer of organic, or not a producer, a processor of organic milk, is not accepting shipments from their Vermont producers anymore. So, give us a sense of I was going to say flavor of how the dairy industry is looking in Vermont and what you see on the horizon.
Well, it's been a certainly been a rugged stretch over the last couple of years. The pandemic did not help things. It stabilized a little bit over the last 12 months. There are some encouraging signs. Some of the trends show exports are doing well. We've returned to butter, cheese, yogurt. Fluid milk has been a challenge because of not as many schools were open during the pandemic, not as many colleges, restaurants, coffee shops, and farmers get their best money on the fluid side. So we've got some issues with the processing of value added on the national scale. It's a federal system. And talking about Horizon, that is one that's a real concern, and we're working on that issue. As you mentioned, Danone Horizon, which is a national, international company, has decided to not buy milk from 89 dairy farmers in Vermont, as well as Maine, New York, and New Hampshire. 28 of those businesses are in Vermont. So we're really focused on trying to see if we can find a market. The only silver lining in this is that they did not cease immediately. So they will continue to buy their milk at least until next August. So we have about a year. We have established a task force at the agency, and we've met a couple of times, and we're going to do our best to find alternatives for these dairy farmers. Many of them are in the hills and valleys of Orange County, Washington County, some down in Rutland. They're sprinkled throughout the state, and we're going to do our best to try to find a market for that milk.
Well, as you say, at least you've got some lead time, which is better than it might be. So best of luck with that. In terms of conventional dairying, talk a little about the price of milk. It's always been volatile, wild swings. It stabilized pretty well for a few years, though, but now it's kind of on the low side. How are farmers doing in terms of their business operations and the cost of production?
Yeah, well, it's a federal system, and it's, you know, the public may not realize this, but the farmers really don't know what they're going to get paid for their product until it's delivered about a month later. And it's a very complicated system with regions and, you know, fluid milk and value-added milk. But I think one trend that's new for a lot, there used to be ups and downs. There used to be, you know, the price would go up for a while, and farmers could maybe recover, invest more in equipment, and et cetera, pay more bills. But over the last 3 or 4 years, it's been really stable or declined. It's been kind of in a rut. I guess we could call it a rut. And that's, of course, something new that they have not experienced. So we've had some obviously have to leave the business. But as you mentioned at the top there, that, you know, our farmers continue to produce about the same amount of milk. We've seen a slight decline in Vermont, but we have just about as many cows as we've had. We had consolidation, much like there's been consolidation in media or insurance or banking, et cetera. There's been consolidation in dairy. And, of course, that puts you in a situation where you don't have as many choices, and that's where it becomes, I think, a little troubling. This is what's troubling with the Horizon situation. There are not a lot of options out there for them now. Back in the old days, you could go from co-op to co-op. You'd be upset with your co-op or decide you wanted to change. You could do that, and they'd take you on. Well, milk handlers aren't taking on new farmers right now, and they've also...
By golly, football season starting up. Leaves are turning in some of the higher elevations. I guess autumn is here, which is, of course, harvest time, right, Secretary Anson-Tebbets?
Absolutely. Farmers markets, just the bounty is coming in now. There's plenty of farmers markets that are open throughout the fall and into the winter. Of course, apple picking time. You being from Addison County has some wonderful orchards. We have one in Cabot now called Burt's. That I like to go to, and Burt's are making an incredible cider donut now. That is, you can get, if you time it right, it's really warm. You can just pick it up. It's by the dozen. It's just awesome. So all that's happening. Yeah, pumpkin season, all that wonderful fall stuff that we enjoy here in Vermont. And of course, as I look out here, the leaves just starting to turn a little bit. We peak up here probably the first week in October is when we usually have the peak up here.
I used to get questions from visitors to the state years ago on when is the peak foliage time in Vermont, and I would always say whenever you're here.
Yeah, there's a wonderful sign in Groton that goes up every fall, and it goes, if you go through Groton State Forest, someone has hand painted the wonderful sign saying peak foliage 232 on Friday.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you recall, Anson, years ago, WDEV broadcast live from Waitsfield because the Chamber of Commerce there decided that the peak foliage moment was 11:12, yeah, you know, a.m. on one particular day. And Ken was there, and Ken Squire, and wow, the whole gang. And we had the local school band.
Well, and of course, it's just tragic when it happens at 12:05 in midnight.
Yes,
when
well,
midnight,
I
when
know.
Peak comes, and that's happened over the history of Vermont when peak is coming 2 o'clock in the morning. But we think it's going to be the daytime this year.
Well, let's hope for the best. We're talking with Anson-Tebbets, our Secretary of Agriculture. You talked about some of the other non-dairy products. Any other products that are new and innovative? I remember when we didn't grow grapes in Vermont, but we do now, for
yeah,
example. So things are changing.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got some wonderful folks making, you know, wine, beer, spirits. You can find them. There's a Vermont Wine and Grape Council. You can Google them and find a number of them. You know, open up, and it's getting close to, I think, harvest time for them as well. We've seen an influx of farm stands pop up. I think is a lot of folks are, when the pandemic hit, a lot of new infrastructure went in for buying directly from the farm. Also with PSAs, where people can purchase their food ahead of time and pick it up weekly, we've seen a tremendous increase in that. From time to time, we're seeing more on-farm accessory businesses pop up, visit the sugar house. We've got something coming up this fall called Maple 100. We are focused on celebrating maple every day of the week, not just in the time we're boiling sap into maple syrup in Vermont. So that's coming up. You're going to see a number of events coming up in September and early October. Look for Vermont Maple 100 with a wonderful array of events, both maybe in the sugar bush, maybe at the restaurant, maybe at a farm stand, et cetera. But so that's coming up as well. So it's a really a great time, as you mentioned. The bounty is coming in, the harvest is coming in, and it's all great stuff to support local agriculture if you can.
Well, a lot of good things happening, and we get an opportunity on an annual basis to recognize them. Just a week ago today was the annual induction into the Agriculture Hall of Fame at the Champlain Valley Exposition in Essex Junction. You emceed the event very ably once again, and tell us about some of the folks who are really outstanding in their field, so to speak.
Yeah, this is just a wonderful event. It was great to see you and Governor Kunin there as well. It recognizes some of the people that have really volunteered their time over the years and really endorsed agriculture, built agriculture. But also it looks to the future as well. So we've got some folks that are really emerging. We have some folks that are emerging leaders, people like Amy Richardson down in Heartland, who's really using her farm to tell her story about agriculture. We recognized Roberta McDonald from Cabot, who built the Cabot brand with the help of her farmers over the years. Folks like that. Bill Rowell, of course, was there. We have just a tremendous amount of folks that we recognize each year, and we're so grateful for the Champlain Valley Fair to spend that special couple of hours recognizing the folks who have made agriculture such a part of our lives and also the folks that are making it a part of our lives to the future.
Well, it was great to honor them indeed. We're chatting with Anson Tebbets, our Secretary of Agriculture, and one of the key reasons that agriculture is so important in Vermont is that it helps our tourist economy, not only agritourism, people engaging in farm stays directly, but it's the open space, the working landscape that attract people to come here. With the declining number of farms, should we be concerned about that, Anson?
I think we should be, and we want our landscape to be active. We don't want it to grow up and just be burdock or brush. And it can grow up so quickly in a very short period of time if the land is not cared for, if it's not mowed, if it's not, if you don't plant on it, and the same goes for our forests as well. So I think it's very, very important that we have a vibrant agriculture economy, because you're right, it's important for our recreation, it's important for our hunting, our fishing, all those things. And Vermont's backbone is agriculture, and the offshoot of it is really, really important. So we need to do all we can to support it, support your local farmer, do the best you can to support your neighbor, but we need to make sure it's a working landscape. And sometimes there's some trade-offs of that as well. Sometimes it can get a little smelly. Sometimes there's some big tractors on the road that maybe slow down your path. But it's all worth it because the offshoot of it is so important to our economy.
Yeah, so we've got just a minute left, but tell us about some of the challenges farmers are facing. A lot of regulations come along that cost them money. I know the feds have helped a little, but is that kind of pressure a real problem for our farmers?
Well, we do have probably the strictest environmental regulations, mainly on our dairy farmers. They are all regulated, depending on size. They're inspected. There's fees attached to that. So yes, I mean, it's a, but there's also a commitment. to improve their practices, which they know improves the environment and improves their bottom line. So we're about 3 or 4 years into this new water quality program. People are stepping up. This week I saw a story on Channel 3 where many of our farmers have turned to injecting the manure directly into the soil. That is wonderful for the environment, and they were also saying that was helping the farmers' bottom line as well.
So that's great.
Lots of work is being done out there.
That's good to hear. We're out of time, unfortunately, but thanks so much, Anson Tebbutt, Secretary of Agriculture, for being with us this morning on Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Jim Douglas sitting in today. We had some great conversations in the last hour with Tracy Dolan, the director of the Vermont Refugee Office, and Anson Tebbutt, our good friend and longtime Secretary of Agriculture. We're honored in this segment to be chatting with Amity Schles, who's the chairman and chief executive officer of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. Amity is much more than that. She's a best-selling author of a number of books about the Great Depression, the Great Society, and most notably for our purposes this morning, a biography of our 30th president, the boy from Plymouth Notch, Vermont, who went on to be the leader of the free world, Calvin Coolidge. So, Amity Schles, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Glad to be with you, Jim.
Well, I suppose the best place to start is at the beginning. Tell us about the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, what its mission is, its activities, and how things are going during this very challenging time.
Well, as Vermonters know, Coolidge grew up in Plymouth in a time without a train, of course, at Plymouth, or even electricity. So you want to imagine a kerosene-lit, hard childhood with sugaring included. And he went on to go to college in Amherst, went down to Amherst, and then developed a political career in Massachusetts before going to Washington. Some of those, our job at the foundation is to expose the values of Coolidge, to impart them to Americans, which include, being frugal. If you're from a farm place, you know how to do that. Being honest with counterparties, and generally being an upright citizen. So the main way we do that, Jim, is through our Coolidge Scholarship, which asks young people to apply for a scholarship in Coolidge's name. And when they apply, they write essays about Calvin Coolidge, so they get to know him. This year, 4,700 kids wrote two essays each about Calvin Coolidge to apply for 5 scholarships. Those who don't win, top 100, are called the Coolidge Senators, though Cal was never a senator himself on the national level. And they learn about Coolidge, too, and we bring them together, and we study how Coolidge approached issues.
Well, I should disclose to our viewers that I have the privilege of serving with you on the board of the foundation. It's been a tremendous honor, one of my so-called retirement activities. I've always been a fan, but I'm even more so now that I've gotten to learn more about his life and legacy. We're chatting with Amity Schles, the CEO of the Coolidge Foundation, and this is an important time because 2021 is the centennial of his vice presidency, and in 2 years, of course, we'll celebrate we'll commemorate the centennial of his ascension to the presidency. And I know that the foundation is going to focus on a lot of important activities as we get toward that important date.
Well, first of all, we should always ask people, are they related to Coolidge? I think you might be related to Coolidge. Is that not correct?
Well, yeah, I learned from the Family History Center out in Salt Lake that I'm his, I don't know, 12th cousin nine times removed or something like that. So, sure.
Well, next summer in 2022, we're going to have a reunion, probably around August 2, which is the anniversary of the night that Coolidge was sworn in, so Barry, Vermont, by his father, by virtue of his father being a notary and a justice of the peace, in Vermont to the presidency upon the sudden and sad passing of President Warren Harding. So 2022 is not, it's the 99th year, not the 100th. But we want to invite people related to Coolidge to perhaps sign up and come to learn about Coolidge. And we're going to reenact the swearing in. It was at 2:47 a.m. We'll, of course, do it at p.m. And to learn all about their families and the Coolidge background. That's one thing we're going to do. Another is that we're preparing a film about Coolidge with various important Vermont personages interviewing for that, a full-length documentary. That's a big endeavor. And you may have seen the cameraman and the producer around the notch if you were there this summer. And, lots of other things. We have a new edition of the Coolidge autobiography, thanks to the family of Calvin Coolidge, the direct descendants who own the rights to that book, which you can share with your kids. And it has an essay by Governor Jim in it, because Coolidge was a governor by temperament and by experience rather than a senator. There are different kinds of U.S. presidents, and the gubernatorial variety is really interesting because, after all, Jim, as you know, governors have run something, a state, and they've had to make trade-offs. They don't just make laws. That's only one part of their job. They live with jobs and administer with laws and administer them. And that's interesting, too, to learn about that and to honor that.
Well, as I say in my essay, all else being equal, I'd rather have a president who has served as governor, because it's the closest kind of job to the presidency, and that certainly was true with Coolidge. He brought that executive experience to the White House a century ago. Next year, of course, is the 150th anniversary of his birth, so that's something to commemorate as well, and we look forward to welcoming a lot of his extended family to Plymouth Notch in August of 2022.
If you have the faintest connection to Coolidge, you're invited, and if you haven't one genetically, you're still invited. This is an inclusive sort of reunion event, that's a warm-up. 2022 and 23 will have other events. We're very grateful for our partner, the state of Vermont, which maintains the site impeccably. It's arguably the most beautiful presidential site in America, isn't it, Jim? Because it's all conserved. You don't see a lot of telephone wires in Plymouth. It's just a little micro environment in a bowl of pines.
It's a beautiful, serene spot, and I hope that everyone will have the opportunity to visit. It's open till around Columbus Day, I think, daily, roughly 10 to 5, I think. So if you haven't been there, or even if you have, down in Plymouth Notch, I hope you'll have a chance to go again. You mentioned the partnership with the state of Vermont. We want to thank the Agency of Transportation, specifically Secretary Joe Flynn, for putting up signs on Interstate 91 and 89 to direct people to the site in Plymouth Notch. That's very helpful, and we appreciate their generous support there.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we have a 5K for Coolidge October 2. We hope you come, and if you don't feel like running, and there's signage, by the way, along the route of this race with factoids about Calvin. If you come to our, sticking to that, what I'll say is, if you feel like walking, you know, Coolidge famously said, "I do not choose to run for president" in 1928. But if you do not choose to run on October 22, you can walk the Coolidge walk as well. This is an exciting event run by Jared Rhodes, who is our debate director at Coolidge. We have high school debate. So that's a good way to visit if you haven't. If you have a child who wants to learn about Coolidge. We have declamation contests from time to time where they give a Coolidge speech on Zoom. And a key one is, Vermont is a state I love.
That was Coolidge's famous speech in September of 1928 when he came to view the flood damage from the previous November that wiped out railroads and took a number of lives in Vermont and was a very devastating experience. And it's a moving brief tribute to his native state. We're chatting with Amity Slays, the CEO of the Coolidge Foundation. You mentioned the scholarship program earlier. This is for high school juniors, right? So those who are beginning their junior year in high school should keep an eye out for the application deadline in the spring. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. The deadline's in the winter, so it'll be this fall. You'll see the application up. It's a very competitive scholarship. It's an academic scholarship. We have had a Vermont winner, Nico Brayton, and we've had two Maine winners. One of them is Wade Wallig, and the other, Matthew Gilbert, who is also an ornithologist and a junior expert in the puffin. But it's for kids, it's for bookish kids, I'd say. It's a wonderful thing to even make senator, which is the top 100. So we encourage the academically oriented to apply for this. We are very, very excited about the scholarship because it gives these kids a way to get to know Coolidge. We also do host classrooms. We've traditionally hosted fourth graders. If you have an eighth grade class, we would love to host you one way or the other. Please do contact Dean Ball, our executive director, dball@coolidgefoundation.org, and maybe we can organize something for your class this year, including, by the way, a visit to your classroom if you and your class cannot make it to Plymouth.
Amity, the foundation has other programs that I think are important for us to mention to our listeners this morning. One is the debate program. Coolidge was a debater, right, at Amherst College and felt strongly about principled, informed debate.
Well, there are two kinds of debate nowadays. One is a little bit philosophical and strange and goes off topic. So, for example, if kids are debating the tax code, an important topic for Calvin Coolidge, they'll go off into other areas. Our debate is very factual. We give the kids the brief, both sides. This year, our students debated, should the rich pay more taxes, the same or less? And they had to learn what the capital gains tax was and what the income tax was and who paid what and that they have different rates. And then they just try both sides. Everybody tries on both sides. And that's very important in education nowadays. The kids get to try on ideas, even if they don't know if they agree with them, so they can make their own decisions later. Debate is a key, it's a sport, but it's a key form of education to when you inform yourself. And what I love about debate is the kids who do well in school don't always do well in debate, but there are kids who do poorly or suboptimally in school who do great in debate, and they flower and they see what they can become. We have a program, we have a cup at the Notch, and that's around the 4th of July, the president's birthday. So if you perform well in one of our pre-debates, whether declaiming a Coolidge speech or an actual debate contest, and we have ways for those who are in no league to compete so they can get to the Notch where they get handed a topic and a brief and meet some experts. We always bring in grown-up experts to talk to the kids so that they can meet someone sort of from the real world. And then they argue both sides like crazy, and we give them wonderful awards, and they have a great time. They also get to compete in the Coolidge Trivia Contest at the Summer Gala, which a lot of kids like very much.
Well, you mentioned that debate is important in education. It seems to me it's important in life, too. We might have a little more civility if people had to study and learn the other side of a particular issue. There are other programs. Tell us about the Citizenship Challenge.
The Citizenship Challenge is for kids who generally live in underprivileged areas. It's funded by our fellow trustee, Judge Janice Rogers Brown. And the premise is that, grown-ups who want to become Americans have to take the citizenship test. And, in fact, we have a naturalization ceremony normally with Judge Murpha at the Notch, so our students can see a naturalization. And the question is, why can't eighth graders collect the same knowledge and know that a senator sits six years or a congressman to basic citizenship civics questions. So we've invited eighth graders or around that age, it can be ninth grade or seventh, to memorize our facts. We have them all on our website, Citizenship Challenge, on our Coolidge Foundation website. You can order up flashcards as well. We've made them, and we have a Quizlet-type app you can practice on to memorize these fact questions. And then you'll be interviewed by a grown-up to see if you can answer 20 of the 100-odd questions you've learned. And if you do well, you get to go to Washington, to Coolidge House, which we have, and compete in the finals. The whole point is we want to be sure eighth graders can prove they know as much as about America as someone who's just becoming a citizen. So it's a challenge and a fun one because it is, a fact-based test.
Well, a lot of activities, and we also started a new podcast. We encourage our listeners to go on the website and connect to some of those episodes with very distinguished guests, including Steve Forbes, who's well-known for his expertise in taxes and economics. I guess we should give the listeners our website, shouldn't we, so that they know where to find everything.
Of course, that's CoolidgeFoundation.org. We're just very proud to have you all. We have a Twitter account, we're on Facebook as well. If you have a factoid about Coolidge, you want to hear about, let us know. We'll be announcing plans for the Coolidge, Connection Family Reunion on the website around December. If you want to sign up for that. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention one program we're just developing. Coolidge, he's an unusual president. He doesn't have a government-funded presidential library. He was before that time. Those libraries start with Herbert Hoover. And Coolidge also really didn't like the idea of the federal government funding him after he was president. So his documents are scattered. Some are at the Vermont Historical Society in Barrie. Some are in Northampton at the Forbes Library, where Coolidge, the Coolidge family made their home. And some are in books. Or at the Library of Congress. So what we're doing is making a digital version of that library on our website, and we invite people to become Coolidge scribes, that is, to edit a speech or some remarks of Coolidge's when we transcribe them. There are always errors in transcription and so on. And then to write a comment about what that speech means to the person. That is, you get to say what you think. And we have over 100 scribes helping us put together incrementally, kind of organically, this virtual library of Coolidge. One thing about Calvin, one has to say, is he was a good writer. He was a better writer than any of us. And he was a little bit homiletic, like a good sermon. When he wrote, he had a column, Calvin Coolidge Says, after he's president, and it was short. Coolidge didn't talk a lot. And both prosaic and profound, wouldn't you say, those columns, Jim?
Yeah, he was very good.
He's very good, and he's way underrated. I have the honor to sit on a C-SPAN presidential poll. Coolidge is always in the 20s. He's moved up a little bit lately. He's way underrated. There's nothing to apologize for, really, in Coolidge. He had a strong civil rights record for the period, for his time. he helped the U.S. economy mightily by respecting it. Vermonters will know is, quote, the business of America, the chief business of America is business. But he also said the chief ideal is idealism. He understood small business. I would say he was the small business president, wouldn't you? So there's a lot of there were riches there. And when you read Coolidge, you just say to yourself, why didn't I read this before?
Well, I hope more of our listeners will read what Coolidge wrote. He wrote all of his own speeches except one, according to historians, and was very thoughtful. You've drifted into this, Amity, but we're in a time in our national political history now that's quite divisive. People seem to be awfully grumpy and complaining about nearly everything and everybody. This is a time more than any others when the Coolidge values can be most relevant, can't they?
I'll mention two. Yes, thank you, Jim. One is that he was civil. He actually says in his autobiography, we encourage you to buy our edition. It has one with the president throwing the baseball on the cover. Anyway, he says in it, well, he was involved in some negative campaigning early in his career, but he realized that when you negative campaign, when you complain about the other guy or trash him, you are wasting time. You could be explaining your policy, right? And that's why debate is natural for him, because both sides have to be polite to each other, even if they don't agree and, you know, fight tooth and nail. But another value of Coolidge I was thinking about when I was listening to the news before we came on the air, maybe prices are up because there's trouble in the supply chain and, the containers are in the wrong place. That's definitely a factor. The economy has had a major shock with COVID. But maybe we have inflation and we're not acknowledging it. Coolidge probably would have said that. He was quite an inflation hawk, and there wasn't much inflation in the Coolidge period. You could argue maybe the Florida land rush, or you could argue the stock prices. But Coolidge always balanced the budget because he wanted to preserve the value of the dollar, the U.S., the coin of the land. And as the talk of inflation ramps up, it's going to be interesting to turn to Coolidge. Many economists dismiss the period of Coolidge because it was a gold standard period where you could get gold for money. Basically, where the dollar was calculated and the number of dollars outstanding by gold as irrelevant. I don't think so. And anyone who's interested in the Bitcoin or Dogecoin or anything related to alternate currencies might like to have a look at economic growth under the gold standard here or in the United Kingdom, because the economies grew well because the money was more stable.
Well put, Amity. I wish we had more time, but the clock is running out on us, and I want to encourage our listeners to go to CoolidgeFoundation.org to learn about all the activities and programs of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. Thank you, Chairman and CEO Amity Schlaes, for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Governor Douglas, for sharing leadership at Coolidge with me and teaching me a lot about delegation.
We'll be right back on Vermont Viewpoint.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Yep, Bill Sayre will be here in about 25 minutes or so, so we hope you'll all continue to listen to WDEV. It's been a privilege to be on Bill's show as a guest a number of times, and he always brings a great perspective to the issues of our day. Well, we're honored to be joined this half hour by Matt Dickinson, professor of political science at Middlebury College, my colleague and friend, and we appreciate your taking time out of a busy schedule to be here this morning. Welcome.
It's
It's my pleasure.
Well, it's been fascinating to watch the public opinion surveys recently. The polls are suggesting that the president's job approval is plummeting. Well, it's all relative, sinking at least. Seems like it's almost down to where President Trump's was at various points in his presidency. We've got a lot of Republicans calling on him to resign for one reason or another. Is this the end of Joe Biden's presidency?
I suspect he's got a few more years in office. It, of course, depends on how you define the end of his presidency. History says that the upcoming midterm elections will not turn out well for him. As you know, the president's party typically loses seats, on average 20 to 25 seats in the House. And there's no reason to suggest that the Democrats will be immune to that in this cycle. But you bring up approval ratings, and that's one of the factors we look at in trying to determine, forecast how many seats are at risk here. The lower the president's approval rating, the more seats, historically speaking, they lose. So 46% is not a good number to be at heading into the midterms. Now, you know, it's a function of, I think, the perception that the Afghan withdrawal was botched, rising COVID numbers. So his approval ratings could change over the next few months, but probably not going to skyrocket up to a point where Democrats can feel secure that they're going to retain their House majorities.
Well, I suppose a lot of people, when they cast their ballots last year, were really voting against the other candidate more than because they loved Joe Biden, right? So perhaps he doesn't come with a lot of goodwill going in, and some of these things like Afghanistan drag him down a little bit. Is there also, Matt, a sense that he is past his prime?
Well, I think you've touched on something important. The support for Biden, I think you're absolutely right, in the election was predicated as much, if not more, on opposition to his predecessor, and we can say his name, Donald Trump. And just as Trump's election, by the way, was predicated in large part on opposition to Hillary Clinton, who was, as you well know, viewed with high levels of disfavor by a significant number of voters. So, yeah, there was no love for Joe Biden. I don't think his election reflected any underlying mandate. But the other point is, in this deeply polarized era of nationalized elections, president's approval ratings tend not to start out nearly as high as they used to with the celebrated honeymoons that you'd see presidents have in the past. And they tend to drop pretty significantly over the course of their presidency. So in that sense, Biden is, I think, par for the course.
We don't often focus on number twos, but I want to get your perspective on the vice president, who seems to be invisible, largely. It reminds me a little of the Dan Quayle era when he was kept out of the public eye after his spelling flub, I guess, at one point. What do you make of that? She was given a number of high-profile assignments that just don't seem to be panning out.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. She was clearly attached at the hip to Biden very early in his presidency. She was trotted out at almost every event that he held, and that is no longer the case. And again, and you know this from your experience as an executive, the second in command, you want somebody who's simpatico to you, not just in terms of your policy, but somebody who you work with well. And I do wonder if there's a generational gap here. I do wonder, too, whether, you know, behind the scenes, she's chafing a little bit at some of the things that Biden is doing. It's really hard to tell. When you think about past presidents and vice presidents, you know, you think of a Cheney-Bush relationship, which by all accounts was quite strong, or, you know, a Jimmy Carter-Walter Mondale, again, quite strong. I'm not clear we're seeing that here, and it may reflect some personal dynamics, but it's so hard for somebody like you or me to really see that on the outside.
I assume that she was put on the ticket for reasons other than compatibility with the nominee, and perhaps, as you suggest, that's evidencing itself now. We're chatting with Matt Dickinson, professor of political science at Middlebury College. What I thought was interesting on those latest poll results is that the president's favorability is sinking among independents, and he obviously needs to hold a certain number of those in order to maintain political capital as well as coattails, if any, during the upcoming cycle. But I guess that's when you're down, right?
Well, but you point out something that's crucially important when we think about elections. Partisans, strong partisans on either side, Republicans or Democrats, are going to vote for their candidate, even if they're holding their nose. It is the independents who, you know, constitute, depending how you define them, anywhere from 10 to 40% of voters, who are the swing portion of the electorate. They're the ones that provide the volatility. They're the ones who are explaining why we go from a Bush to an Obama to a Trump to a Biden over the, you know, the last four administrations alternating partisanship. They're the ones who are most likely to defect and say, I'm willing to give a flyer to the candidate of the opposing party. So you are quite right. When we're looking at this drop in approval ratings, losing support among Republicans isn't particularly surprising and probably not worrisome for Biden. Losing support among independents is worrisome.
We're talking with Matt Dickinson from Middlebury College. I wanted to ask you about the dynamics within the parties. We've got a 50-50 U.S. Senate, and my former colleague and buddy Joe Manchin is getting a lot of attention because he is a senator from a state that Donald Trump carried by 40 points. And the new senator from Arizona, Senator Sinema, is showing an independent streak, too. And then some of the squad, the ultra liberals in the party, want them run out of town on a rail, I guess. And then on the Republican side, there are the Trump loyalists and those who really think that we ought to move on from that era. So how do those intra-party dynamics play into the president's agenda and popularity and next year's midterms?
So it's a fascinating story. If you have been paying attention, as I know you have been, the legislative dynamics, particularly on the two crucial portions of Joe Biden's agenda, which will go a long way, by the way, to determining whether he gets reelected, and that, of course, is the infrastructure bill, the more narrowly defined one, the one constructed by this bipartisan coalition. But also this budget resolution, which contains a lot of items, $3.5 trillion budget, which is being fleshed out as we speak in Congress, the Democrats cannot afford literally to lose a single vote in the Senate to get this reconciliation budget bill through under rules that, you know, prevent it from being filibustered. What that means is every single Democrat is a potential veto point, but it also means any single Democrat can't possibly hope to achieve their objectives, whether they're the squad in the House on the far left or Joe Manchin on, you know, the center, without the support of everyone else. So it is a really tricky negotiating process. And you see individual members of Congress, and Joe Manchin has been probably the most vocal on this, saying out loud, I can't support this. I can support this, as a way of sort of signaling during this legislative negotiation what he will accept and not. Now, talk is cheap. You went through these negotiations with an opposition-controlled legislator. You could say all sorts of things in order to sort of signal your intentions, but in the end, the Democrats all know if they don't want a failed presidency here, they have to pass something, and that means they all have to hang together, or they most assuredly will hang separately, to quote a famous politician.
Well, it's interesting to see that dynamic. Sometimes I think that the president is governing as if he were LBJ with huge majorities in both chambers and an overwhelming win at the polls. But in fact, he barely squeaked by and has a closely divided Congress. And I wonder why he doesn't reach out a little more. He's had some meetings with Republicans on infrastructure and some other issues. But Doesn't seem to be trying too hard, does he?
You know, it's hard to tell what signals he's getting from a much more progressive House leadership, you know, Nancy Pelosi, a San Francisco Democrat, and who also, by the way, is dealing with her own progressive wing of her caucus and trying to hold that together, the squad. And Chuck Schumer, who is no shrinking violet ideologically either. But you raise an important point. When you think about the recent presidencies, there's this tendency for them to be elected on a promise to unify, to heal. You remember Biden's victory speech, he's going to heal America. And this is something that Obama said and Bush said, I'm a uniter, not a divider. But when they try to govern, they have this caucus that is typically to a certain extent, more ideologically extreme than the general populace that voted you into office, and you have to deal with that caucus. And there's been a tendency for legislative overreach. Now, in some cases, for instance, Obama passing health care and this stimulus bill, you can get that legislation through, but then you often risk a backlash from a more moderate public that thinks this was too much too soon. And you saw what happened in 2010 with the rise of the Tea Party. Similarly, Donald Trump, on the advice of Paul Ryan, you know, trying to repeal health care, and that cost his party votes in 2018. So I, again, think you raise an important point here. Biden has to be very careful in pushing a budget bill that, in some respects, is the biggest governmental expansion since the New Deal. Is that something that more moderate Americans and those independent voters that you alluded to, are they going to swallow that whole heading into the midterms? I'm doubtful.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention once again, as we did at the outset of the show this morning, that today is the 80th birthday of Vermont's junior United States Senator. And Matt, I'd be interested in your thoughts on his role now as chairman of the Budget Committee. He seems like he's on the presidential campaign trail in Iowa and other places trying to sell a budget, I guess.
Yeah, it's a fascinating evolution in his role after years of being sort of a Democratic gadfly or a Democratic socialist gadfly who was really more interested in providing a moral conscience to the Democrats and pointing out their shortcomings on that yardstick than actually accomplishing anything. He's now in a position as chair of the Budget Committee. He has an institutional responsibility to the party's success. And so it makes sense that he's out there on the stump trying to drum up grassroots support, particularly in states that went Republican, although that's an interesting choice of targets. But the risk, I think, and this is more speculation than based on polling evidence, is I'm not sure, again, if you're worried about independents defecting from you, that Bernie Sanders is the guy to carry your water visibly on this budget bill. I mean, he has a track record of being a Democratic socialist, and is that really the guy to convey the message that I'm a unifier, that as president I appeal to both parties? I'm with you. I think the best road for success here is passing legislation that has some buy-in from both parties rather than passing a bill that squeaks by solely on the basis of the votes from one party. I mean, that is what's triggered the backlash in past years. So I think there's a risk here having Bernie as the visible face of this legislative agenda.
We were chatting in the past half hour with Amity Schles, the CEO of the Coolidge Foundation, and we were talking about the era a century ago when politics were a little different from what they are today, and President Coolidge used to invite Democratic lawmakers to the White House where he would feed them griddle cakes with Vermont maple syrup to try to sweeten them up. And, you know, sometimes it worked, not all the time, but at least he reached out and spent a lot of time with folks from the other party, and we just don't seem to see as much of that today. And things are playing out in different forums. I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. We've got, the new abortion ruling or tentative ruling from the Supreme Court on the Texas law. We've got these new voting procedure statutes that are being passed and getting a lot of pushback. We've got mask mandate fights in some places. How do you think these issues play out and or affect the mood of the electorate or might impact either the president's agenda or the elections next year, if at all?
Well, it's an interesting and I think problematic aspect of American politics in that our conversation is dominated by representatives from the more ideological extreme wings of the parties, and not just elected officials, although they certainly play a huge role, but I'm talking about the cable news talking heads and the individuals who donate in small amounts through PayPal and other online means, and activists who generally are the most visible advocates for policies. We know they are not representative of what, again, the majority of Americans think or believe. And moreover, their agenda, the issues they talk about, for instance, you mentioned the abortion ruling, are not issues that are central to the daily concerns of most Americans who are worried about, you know, educating their kids. Now, the mask mandate obviously has some implications for that, but it's taken on a prominence that's far beyond what the evidence says one way or the other here, and it's become a cultural litmus test for where you stand on a whole range of issues. And my worry here, Governor, is that as these loud voices continue to dominate, the majority of Americans are just – the tendency is to tune out. And the sort of the general belief is I don't really believe either side. And that also makes them more susceptible to, if not conspiracy theories, a general distrust of our political institutions, whether it's Congress, the Supreme Court, the police departments, the military. And I think that decline, that erosion in trust is not a good thing for American politics.
I certainly agree. Matt, we've got a couple minutes left. I want to go back to something you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, that the president's party almost invariably loses seats in midterm elections. There are a couple of exceptions in the last century and generally a logical explanation for them. I'd be interested in your thoughts on what the models suggest the number of those losses might be next year for the Democrats in both the House and Senate. And secondly, what effect congressional reapportionment might have on the prospects for the two parties next year?
Oh, great question. So when we generate our forecast models, we being political scientists, for the midterms, and we have fairly well-developed understanding of what the dynamics are here. We're looking at three things, really, which is the state of the economy, the macroeconomy, however you want to measure that. Two, as we talked about, the president's approval rating. And three, how many seats are at risk? The more seats you control as a party, obviously, the more vulnerable seats you probably have. And two of those aspects heading into the midterms, the Democrats are actually in pretty good shape. The economy, you know, it's not booming, but it's incrementally expanding as it was under Trump after COVID. And the Democrats don't have a lot of seats occupied by Democrats in districts, for instance, that voted for Donald Trump. So those bode well. The problem, of course, is the president and the approval rating. So right now I'm guessing Democrats are going to lose, on average, 2 seats in the Senate, maybe 11 seats in the House. But, of course, that would cost them their majority in both if those predictions come true. We'll have to see. Again, it's a little bit early on this. And of course, I've completely forgotten your second question.
Redistricting, reapportionment.
Ah, yes, redistricting. That throws a little bit of a monkey wrench. Of course, as you know, we're in this process every 10 years of allocating seats on the basis of population changes, and those are intensely partisan processes. And generally speaking, both parties are going to try to draw seats in ways that are going to maximize their likelihood of winning. I think it's too early to tell.
And Matt, we're going to have to leave it at that, I'm afraid.
Okay.
We're going to leave our audience hanging and pick it up another time. But thanks so much for your time this morning, Matt Dickinson, professor of political science at Middlebury College. We'll see you around campus. And we'll see you all on the radio.